Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just spoke with Sean Bender about his really engaging new book, Taiko Boom, Japanese Drumming in Place and Motion, that was published with the University of California Press this year in 2012. Now, this is a book that's so much fun to read and really informative and enlightening and engaging in many ways. It's not only a study of just a really interesting and inherently interesting form of performance, form of music, form of community engagement and cultural engagement in Japan, it's also really informative and suggestive in terms of the way we think about the importance of locality and bodies and the relationship between the two in constructing and in the context of changing notions of community in Japan, but also I think elsewhere as well. It's a great book. It was a lot of fun to talk with Sean about it, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Sean.
Hi.
We're here today at New Books in East Asian Studies to talk with Sean Bender about his new book, Taiko Boom, Japanese Drumming in Place and Motion. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Sean, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. Very glad to be here with you today.
So, Sean, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you into the field of anthropology of Japan? And furthermore, what brought you into this particular topic?
Well, the two are related in a way. Shortly after I finished college, I went to Japan to teach English. This was in the early 90s when a lot of people did that and when the economic future of Japan looked a lot more promising than it does today, I guess you could say. And during that time, toward the end of my stay there, I actually had the opportunity to play taiko, which is the subject of the book. And taiko are basically Japanese drums, I guess is the easiest way to describe them. And I had a really good time. As by way of some more background, from a very young age, I've played drums of the Western variety. And so I was very excited to have the opportunity to play on something because I hadn't had that opportunity while I was in Japan. And so it was a lot of fun. And I kept it. It was sort of in the back of my mind when I came back to the States after leaving Japan. People would often ask, what did you enjoy most about your time in Japan? And I would say a number of things, but I would often reference that time playing taiko. And when I came back from Japan to the States, I actually came back to enter into an anthropology program. I decided that while I was over in Japan that I actually wanted to pursue cultural anthropology on the graduate level. But coming into anthropology, I didn't anticipate that I would do anything with taiko again. When I saw it originally, I just thought of it as another one of many Japanese traditional arts. And at that time, it wasn't really popular for anthropologists to do studies of traditional arts in Japan. But over time, I started to learn more about taiko. Now, I should preface this by saying that taiko refers to a drum, an instrument itself, but it also more recently has come to refer to an entire genre of performance where people put the drums into arrangements like an ensemble and perform primarily on stages and play. So people often use taiko to describe both the drum and then the genre in which it's used like that. So I learned more about taiko, the genre itself, and found out that it was actually relatively new and not the traditional art that I had thought that it was and that many people that I encountered thought that it was. And that intrigued me quite a bit because at the time there was a lot of discussion in the social sciences humanities about the concept of invention of tradition, and the field of Japan studies was no exception. A lot of people were talking about that at that time, and I thought that studying the taiko, the ensemble form of taiko, would be an interesting way of engaging that academic discourse. And it turns out as well that at least the time that I started my study, nobody had done any serious scholarly work in English on Japanese taiko drumming. And in fact, there was very little in Japan done by Japan scholars, at least from a more social scientific perspective on taiko. There were some musicologists who had done some studies looking at different kinds of taiko drums and taiko drum playing across Japan, but there are a few that approached it in the more sort of holistic ethnographic way that I wanted to. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, that's great. So this started off as a doctoral dissertation. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about that that process of transforming this from a dissertation into a book manuscript? Were there any major changes, major transformations, major revelations or problems, or was it relatively smooth or some combination? What was the process like for you?
Yes, it took some time. One of the things that I discovered very quickly when I went into the field and actually started talking to taiko drummers in Japan was that very few of them actually thought of what they were doing as the quote-unquote traditional practice or traditional art. And this is perhaps most prominent in the group of drummers that is featured most often in the book and that I work with most closely, who are a group called Kodo. And Kodo very explicitly talks about their activities as being artistic and creative rather than traditional. So basically where I'm going with this is that I had to sort of abandon the invention of tradition framework that I went into the field with when I was actually putting the dissertation together, because it didn't really work. I mean, if you really want to talk about invented tradition, you at least have to be agreed upon that what you're studying is tradition. That makes sense. And people kind of have to be invested in it as tradition to even talk about it as non-invented or invented. And so if it's not traditional, then that presents a problem to look at it from that perspective. I still think, though, that critical perspective that you get, the coming out of the more critical appraisal of traditional practices is useful. And there are maybe some elements of it in the dissertation. But even in the dissertation, I had to abandon that and come up with a different way of sort of imagining how to understand these groups. And one of the terms that I came up with that I used throughout the book is this notion of new folk. Within the context of Japan, I think it makes most sense. You could perhaps apply it elsewhere, but within Japanese society, I think it makes sense as a way of understanding the kind of musical practices that we see taiko drummers pursuing. So I primarily used the dissertation as a way of talking about taiko as a new kind of Japanese musical practice that's different from traditional Japanese arts, but is also at the same time somewhat distinct from what we would identify with Japanese popular culture, like the J-pop stars or K-pop stars that are quite popular now across the world. So it seemed to be somewhere in between those two, but yet really not comfortably fitting into either category. So in many ways, the dissertation was a way for me to kind of work through and flesh out this new sort of category of new folk performance, which I think of taiko as sort of quintessence, if you will, the quintessential representative of. In the book, by contrast, I shift the perspective a little bit. I move away from staying within that academic discourse of invented tradition and think a little bit more about the notions of space and place and draw from a different academic discourse of globalization. To some extent, this was implicit even in the dissertation, but it wasn't brought out as much as I bring it out in the book. And I think it makes many of the things that I was looking at in the book more sensible to place it in that context of globalization. And what I mean by this is thinking about how people sort of newly map culture onto places. And in other words, how you can kind of disengage culture from specific territories and analyze the process by which people affix the two. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I use that. Now, a lot of people talk about globalization as sort of movements, international, transnational movements of culture and the like. And I think that that's important, and I don't have any problem with that. But I think that you can also push that line of thinking a bit further and not just talk about it between nation states or national units, but you can also look at similar processes even within societies. I think a lot of the people do that, but I thought that at least in the recent academic writing on Japan, that often that element of globalization kind of gets lost. And I thought that it not only is implicit in the study itself in terms of how Taiko actually emerged, but really I think the case of Taiko really helps to show how that academic perspective is valid for understanding what's going on in Japan. So if you were to contrast the dissertation to the book, whereas the dissertation was perhaps more steeped in the 80s and 90s than discussions about tradition, invention, and nationalism and the like, the book breaks a little bit with that academic discourse and takes up more recent discourses and discussions of globalization and the production of place through culture.
That's great. And that's actually really useful as a way of getting us started to get actually into the meat of the book itself. Now, the book itself, it's broken up into two parts. The first one contextualizes the emergence of Taiko and the popularization of Taiko. And the second part sort of brings us into more contemporary Taiko practices. Now, as you said, the notions of the global and the local and the sort of a very sophisticated aggregation of the two are really central for what's going on here. So the title of the book comes from what you're arguing here, I think obviously very successfully, is a Taiko boom that happened in the closing decades of the 20th century. This is a period in which you say it's arguably become Japan's most globally successful performing art. But again, exactly the way, or very much along the lines of what you've said just now, that globalization is really bound up in various ways in which the local is extraordinarily important to this practice. And so this ramifies in several ways, and then we'll sort of get into part one of the book.
Sure.
You talk about the importance of Taiko performing locality within national and global flows, the concern for performing local place, and this is one of the things I'm really looking forward to talking with you about, localized techniques of body discipline, which is really interesting. And in fact, all the way up to, you mentioned participants who are apprenticing in Taiko groups that you were doing some of your field work in, citing a desire to travel around the world and see the globe as one of the reasons they were doing this in the first place. So it's very, very important, and I think this is a book that, for those reasons, is really interesting for readers who might be interested in thinking the local and thinking about how to treat a kind of locally situated history or ethnography, even if they may not think that they're interested in Taiko drumming, you know, in the first place. So I think there's a very wide reach here methodologically.
Okay.
So, and these are all really good things. And so this is one of the reasons I think this is a really interesting book to talk about. So let's get into it. So part one of the book, as we said, examines the factors that led up to what we then look at in the second part as the Taiko boom. And in part, this focuses on how Taiko emerged within shifting and transforming patterns of community organization in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of the things that the book does at the beginning, chapter one, you're introducing the basic elements of Taiko, the drums, the drum makers. But one of the really interesting discussions within this is your explanation of the ways that Taiko helped bring previously marginalized members of Japanese society into the mainstream. So can you talk about that for us? How did Taiko help bring previously marginalized members of society into the mainstream? And I think Barakumin in particular is what you talk about here.
Yeah, the Barakumin are the preeminent example of that.
Mm-hmm.
To explain a little bit who they are, they're, I guess you could say, a historically outcast group in Japan. for at least several hundred years, starting perhaps most clearly in the early 17th century, but perhaps even before that. They were tasked with certain sorts of occupations that were believed to be polluting. Because of certain Buddhist prohibitions on the killing of animals, it was only which was believed to be a polluting activity. Any kind of contact with death was seen to be abhorrent from the Buddhist perspective, and so this kind of horrible but necessary duty of dealing with not only dead people but dead animals was basically assigned to a certain group of people who've come to be known as Buddhakumin. Okay. Now, there's a more complex emergence of it, and some Buddhakumin scholars might quibble with the details here, but that's just a general, to give people a general sense of what I'm talking about. That's where they're sort of coming from. Well, given that taiko drums are usually an amalgam of wood, metal, and animal skin, it makes sense why Buddhakumin would be involved in their manufacture as well. And in fact, they were for several hundred years. And one of the taiko manufacturers that I talk about in detail actually received their charter in the early 17th century to make taiko drums, and had been making taiko drums and continued to make taiko drums up until the present day. But really, until this increase of interest and activity around taiko in terms of these new groups emerging, they did so in relative obscurity, I guess you could say. And I think it's a kind of a difficult argument to make, because what I'm trying to say is that we can see evidence of an increase of interest or popularity of taiko, which is, I call the taiko boom, and other people call it taiko boom as well, by virtue of the fact that Buddhakumin businesses are increasing in scale. But at the same time, they're doing so because there's increased demand for the drum. So the two processes are sort of working in motion. I'm sort of saying this is happening. It's also evidence for the taiko boom, but at the same time, it's an outcome. It's a product or an effect of the taiko boom. So it's almost, perhaps you could say there's a little bit of circularity there, but I don't think it's a critical flaw in the argument. But the effect of that, I think, is twofold. Not only are you seeing these businesses succeeding in a way that they hadn't in the past because of the, well, at least domestic and even now international popularity of taiko groups, but in addition, it's also in perhaps an unanticipated effect of that is, given that taiko drumming is so has become so normalized and popular, that the products of the labor of these groups has taken on new value. And so you've seen an increase in interest on the part of the makers of taiko to actually talk about what they're doing as a good thing, a valuable service. And getting back to the subject of tradition again, it takes on a kind of new valence. Where in the past, you might have thought about these people as having been tasked with this labor, in many senses, against their will. And the fact that they had continued it and pursued it for so long is in essence, evidence of the fact that they really had very few other options in society in terms of occupations, what to do. At the same time, that's a historical truth. But we see, when you look at Buddhaku businesses, and I focus on one in particular called Asano Taiko, which is up in Ishikawa Prefecture, at the same time, in their marketing of their drums, they, in a sense, reappropriate that past, that somewhat negative past of being historically assigned to do this labor, as a very positive thing. That essentially they have many centuries now of experience and knowledge in taiko production. And so from that perspective, I think they're better able to sort of state that they're not only important, they've been important contributors to Japanese culture for a long time, but also to take a kind of newfound pride in their work. And so that's what I'm popularity, the people who are actually involved in producing the drums are brought into increasing, I guess, say, mainstream profile and sort of mainstream appreciation of their labor and contributions to this new art form. And so from that perspective, they've previously marginalized groups like the Burakumin have sort of been brought closer into the mainstream of Japanese cultural consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely. And one of the really interesting things in that chapter too is you take us into, and you take us along a special road, the road of human rights and taiko in Osaka. So it's really interesting
right
there. Now the next,
yes. That goes along with that. So, and it's not only this one taiko company that has sort of marketed its tradition as well and proudly proclaimed its heritage, but you see this happening in a community very far away in Osaka, in a community that's very famous for taiko manufacture as well. That's right.
Right. So as we get into later on into this part of the book, the next chapter gives us and traces the history of the four groups that have been most important to contemporary taiko in
right
terms of its instruments, its stage performance and techniques, and the
right
kinds of pieces in the repertoire. So some of these include Osawa Daiko, which is arguably the first ensemble taiko group, and which is really interesting for its incorporation of jazz, sort of inspirations from jazz drumming into
right
the ensemble. And you also take us through another group called Sukeroku Daiko, which is, I kind of thought of as a sort of taiko boy band. And I know that's probably inappropriate, but I think I kind of like to think of it that way. What I want to ask you to talk a little bit about is the third one that you introduce us to, because this allows us to segue into Kodo this, which is where you did a lot of your field work and where a lot of the story actually focuses. But before there was Kodo, there was Ondekoza.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the Ondekoza group and its context? Sort of why, how did it emerge and why is it important to the early history of taiko drumming?
Yeah.
Very, very narrow question, I know. This is
No. I do spend a lot of time talking about this particular group in the book, so I understand why you're asking. And it has a quite a long history, I guess you could say. But to sum it up, the founder of the group is named Den Tagayasu, is his name. And Den was a person who's very interested in Japanese folklore, scholarship, and also Japanese folk performing arts. And he was a very left of center politically active guy who was active when he was growing up in labor movements, student movements at university, then also labor activism later on, and had a very kind of almost Maoist perspective on the rural life, peasantry, and the arts that they produced. And so at a certain time in his life, he traveled around Japan in emulation of one of his intellectual fathers, a guy named Miyamoto Tsuneichi, who was a folklore scholar as well and was famous for doing basically on-the-ground fieldwork in the way that anthropologists often do, but folklore scholars didn't often do. Instead of just studying folktales, he would often go and visit villages and do very close up studies of them. And so through these experiences, Den set upon the idea of starting a kind of arts group of younger people. And his hope in starting this group was to try to reinvest the folk art that he liked with a kind of youthful energy. One of the things that claimed that he discovered when he would go around Japan looking at folk arts is that they were often quite, shall we say, sort of weak in impact. And this is sort of reflective of the people who are playing them, who tended to be more elderly, less impressive than they perhaps were in the past. And so he was sort of captivated by this idea that the folk arts and folk culture of Japan was sort of dying away, and he essentially wanted to kind of help reinvest it with the energy that it originally had. So, I mean, there are some other factors that led to it, but ultimately he invited, put out an open call for some young people to join him on an island called Sado, which is off the coast of Niigata Prefecture in Japan, in the summer of 1969, and had them interact with several public intellectuals of the time, talking about the value of folk society and the like. And this was a time of student movements in Japan, so there was a political dimension to this kind of activity as well. And ultimately, at the end of this few days interacting with all these luminaries, he asked that some of the students wanted to stay with him and start a group that would be primarily composed of taiko drumming, but not exclusively at this time, and would basically travel around the world demonstrating sort of folk, the impressiveness of Japanese folk culture to audiences around the world. Now, ultimately what happened is, many things happened, but ultimately one of the things that he wanted to include, for example, in the early days was a form of puppet theater that was native to Sado Island as a local folk tradition. And so it was a primarily drumming and puppet theater group, which is could be seen as kind of an interesting combination, but only makes sense in the context of this particular locality of Sado, where the two are quite well known. And the group the name Ondekoza itself comes from a Sado dialect for a type of festival drumming there called Ondeko or Onidaiko, which is roughly translated as demon drumming. It's performed in various ways across the island at certain times of the year, kind of like an almost like a harvest festival or something like that, a sort of religious communal festival. Where the Oni will come and dance in front of your house and bless your house, basically, for the upcoming year with good fortune. And so Ondekoza takes that local name and presents itself as sort of a group helping to revive Sado customs, as it were. But very few people from Sado itself actually are in the group. In fact, the group is mostly composed of people from outside Sado Island. And the puppet theater aspect of the group starts to drop out, and they ultimately become more of a taiko-focused group that starts to travel around the world to essentially raise money for what Dan originally pitched to the group as an artisan academy. The word artisan is coming from the term shokunin in Japanese, which can be translated as artisan or craftsperson in English, but has a slightly different connotation in Japanese. The shokunin were one of the rungs in feudal society. They were one of the occupational castes, if you will, that existed in the sort of feudal early modern period from the 16th century up to the 19th century. And the notion of the artisan has a little bit more of a fuller, I guess you could say, categorical meaning in Japanese than it does in English. We think of artisan in the U.S. as primarily in reference to cheese and bread, primarily. But in Japan, it's almost like an attitude towards one's work, art, or craft as an almost like ceaseless devotion to trying to improve the ability with which you, say, build houses or make swords or make baskets, whatever it is that you're tasked with actually producing. And so, very much so, Dan and the members of Ondekoza valued that artisan ethic. And so they wanted to start an artisan academy, not so much a university on the model of Tokyo University or Kyoto University or Harvard, any of these intellectual-leaning institutions, but in a university, a kind of academy that would essentially help to foster the development of artisanal, you know, that sort of artisanal ethic of making things. And they saw traveling around the world playing taiko as the means of raising funds in order to start this. Now, originally when he pitched the idea, Dan said that after they made this artisan academy, they would essentially stop performing and just pursue their lives working within this artisan academy. But that really never happened for a number of reasons. They became increasingly known as a taiko group, not necessarily playing old taiko pieces or pieces that are connected up with specific festivals in Japan, but for essentially their rearrangement of them. I mean, they would take elements, they would be inspired by take elements from folk arts in Japan, but then also through a number of processes transform them into stage and performance pieces. And I guess you could say the irony of it is, well, one of the many ironies is that many of the pieces that they've developed through this process of transformation have in turn, because of their popularity and visibility within Japan, been sort of reappropriated by amateur taiko ensembles in Japan and outside Japan as well, and have become almost a new kind of a folk culture. So in a sense, they tried to sort of revitalize the folk culture that then saw sort of dying out around Japan, but in the process actually created somewhat of a new kind of folk culture, which is another reason why I use that term, new folk, but also tells us a little bit about their contribution as a group.
Great. Now, one of the things that comes out of this part of the book as being really notable about Den Tageyasu's his kind of methodology is it really kind of gets us to one of the other major themes that emerges out of the book, which is the focus on and the importance of sort of an embodiment and a focus on bodies in the practice of taiko drumming. Now, he had a very particular vision for the group and a very particular training style, which is very intensely physical, and there are mentions of marathons. Can you talk a little bit about that as a way to sort of move us to thinking about this other major theme that you raise for us?
Sure. I may talk about some other aspects of the book in this, but I mentioned in the section where I talk about Ondekozai and its emergence, how some people thought it was hard to tell at the beginning whether it was a group of musicians or a group of runners, because they would often be running so much, and there were so many of the people in the group were so interested in running. Coincidentally, at this time, early 1970s, there's something of a marathon boom that some people describe. Boom is a word used in Japanese to describe any sort of recent sort of trend or something that people are enthusiastic about. So coincidentally, while the drummers were experimenting with these drums, they were also very interested in running, and the idea of sort of training your body through running, in some senses, Den saw this as a way to replace the kind of strength and muscularity that people had naturally as a result of growing up, to say, in a farming community, either as an artisan or a farmer, where you'd be engaged in manual labor, some kind of manual labor all day long, and so strengthen your body through that. But he felt that most young people in Japan now didn't have that kind of strength, and that one of the reasons why the folk arts of Japan were not only dying out but losing their impact is because he felt that people who actually had powerful bodies that were wrought through these kinds of daily labors were not really performing of these folk traditions anymore. And so that's what he was trying to, in a sense, recreate in this group, Ondekozai. But I think it goes even a little bit further than that. I think that clearly Ondekozai takes it to another level. And I should mention that in 1981, the members of the group, the younger members of Ondekozai, break off with Den. And that's when you see the emergence of this group, Kodo, that has continued to the present day, living on Sado Island, where Ondekozai was originally based. But after 1981, after a couple of years break, Den actually went on to form another Ondekozai in another part of Japan. And this new Ondekozai was not as locally rooted as in Sado, or in one place as the original group was in Sado, and moved around quite a bit. But in one of its iterations in the 90s, the group actually traveled to the United States and literally ran around the United States. And then they did the same thing a few years later in China and literally ran around China. That is, they would perform a concert and then run to the next concert location. And it's kind of incredible when you think about it. So in a sense, they took it even a step further than Kodo. Kodo never did that after 1981. But it kind of shows you something of the commitment to this idea of running and sort of physical training that was implicit into the early days of Ondokuza and their interactions with this Dentage as a character. Kodo, in some ways, has taken a different direction. But yes, this training of the body was very, very important for Ondokuza and still remains to be important to Kodo as well. But I'd argue further, and I do in the book, that it's important to taiko as a genre of musical performance in general. That one of the things I think that I was very struck by, because I actually had the opportunity to play a little bit when I was doing my research, was the attention that people brought to the way your body is actually moving when playing this, you know, this kind of music. Now, most people would even classify it as a kind of music in the West, but that was problematic as a categorization in Japan. In fact, some people would even say to me that the word ongaku is the word for music in Japanese, and some people would say that they didn't even think of taiko as ongaku, because ongaku has such a Western connotation of classical music and a sort of European orientation that some people thought that sound production on these drums could not really be considered a kind of music, even though that's what we classify it as. But even tentatively classifying it as music, as I do, is also somewhat problematic because it misses the other aspect of it, which is connected up with physical movement. And it's not so much that you're hitting the drum and producing a sound by as the result of that strike of the drum, but the way that you actually hit the drum is almost as important, if not more important, than hitting the drum itself. To some extent, the proper execution of a movement to hit the drum means that you will have the proper sound coming out of it. To an extent, say in snare drumming or marching percussion or in drum set in the U.S. or in the West, you have this notion that you have to use your stick and move your stick in a particular way to get a good sound. But typically, the emphasis is on minimizing as much as possible the motion that you're using in order to produce the sound, because you want the focus to be on the sound that's coming out of the drums itself. But this is a real distinction between that style of drumming and what you're seeing in taiko drumming, where the movement of the body itself is as important, if not more important, than the actual sounds that are being produced. For the most part, the rhythms and patterns that taiko groups use are not very complex, especially compared with African drumming or other kinds of drumming around the world, even Korean style someone learned. The difference is that it's quite beautiful to watch the production of these fairly rudimentary sounds in the case of taiko. So I think the two things are very closely related, that the emphasis on the body in Kodo and Ondekoza is connected very clearly with the interest in the artisanal ethic and the strengthening of the body in order to correctly produce folk culture. But at the same time, it's also implicit in many ways in the art form itself, the way it emerged and developed as something distinctive of the Japan at the time that it came to life, as it were, in that in the focus on the body in performance is something that, at least to my knowledge, we don't see as much in many other drumming traditions around the world.
Mm-hmm. And even, I mean, in this, the importance of this actually leads me to mention something, one seemingly really small point in the book, but that's very, very telling. In the next part of, or in the next chapter, which I won't ask you too much to talk too much about, because then we'll sort of move to the second part of the book. But there's this really wonderful account of some of the major works that became famous taiko works in the Ondekoza and Kodo repertoires. And one of them in particular, this Odaiko work, there's a case of that really makes manifest in a very... Well, that really makes manifest the importance of the visuality, of the visual experience of the performing body during Taiko. And then I'm talking about the case in which the group performs for Pierre Cardin, and he watches it and says, "That's great, but you know, and you know what? I would love for you to come back and play a few more times, and I'll pay you. But here's the thing. I'd like you to wear loincloths, or the one guy in particular to wear a loincloth instead."
Right.
Which is, you know, it brings up the importance of this sort of this kind of spectatorship relationship and the gendered, the importance of gendered bodies here. That's going to persist in importance later on in the book as well.
Right, exactly. Right, in a sense, the way I put it in the book and the way I think of it is that essentially the loincloth, and I have to say, because, and I do mention this as a footnote in the book, that there are a lot of people who, that this is a fairly contentious idea, that Pierre Cardin put forth this idea to Ben Tagayasu. There are some people who strongly advocate the idea that, the view that he didn't say this, and that they, in fact, had performed that way from a long time before. And there's some evidence of that in the fact that they performed at the festival with a loincloth. However, the documentary record is what it is, and at least Dan is down in interviews that have been published as saying that Pierre Cardin, in fact, did say this to him, and he got the idea from Pierre Cardin. So I take him at his word, even though there are people who fiercely disagree. But I think the effect of this is, as you say, is that essentially it draws even more attention to the bodies of the performers themselves. In this case, it's always male performers. The Kodo group, and even Onde Kosa after them, never have women playing only in loincloths. The Odaiko. And so there's a sort of an implicit sort of, as you say, gender component to the performance of that piece. But you could also say it's also somewhat exclusive, because the piece of Odaiko has turned into almost like a generic performance. It was a specific piece in the repertoire of Onde Kosa, but now so many other groups have duplicated it that it's become almost a kind of performance number in itself in a generic way. And so you see many people playing this, and there are other groups where you see women playing, but very few do you see where women are in loincloths. So, and it's often a quite a privileged piece as well, but typically it's the most senior members of group that get to play it, or those who are the most proficient on the drum. But yes, as you say, it drew new attention to the bodies, very impressive physical physiques of these young drummers at that time, and then at the present day as well. I just gave a talk the other day where I showed pictures of Kodo's most recent concert poster, and you know, it has three drummers in loincloths, right? Prominent in the center of the poster. So regardless of its origins, it has taken on very, very significant meaning within the group. It's become a very much so identifier of them and their style, their approach to drumming, as it were.
Now, you mentioned briefly the women, the issue of women playing taiko, and since there's an entire chapter on this, let's move to that briefly for a moment. I mean, I think for listeners, I'll mention, who've never heard taiko, who might be curious, it's really easy to go to YouTube and basically put in, you know, Kodo Taiko YouTube. One of the first videos that comes up, I just watched this before we were talking, is a video of the Kodo group, and they're sort of, it alternates between these images of this natural landscape, right? This very, you know, the cherry blossoms falling and so on and so forth, and images of them on stage. And there's one woman performer who's really prominent. And as you watch them, the faces and the bodies of the male performers of this Kodo group that we've been talking about, and that you can actually see on YouTube, are very intense, right? They're scrunching up their faces. They're very focused. And the one woman who's sort of front and center is always kind of smiling, right? She's smiling at you. She's happy. She's cheerful. It's very, very striking. And especially after reading this chapter 6 in your book, where you talk about the particular challenges facing women taiko drummers and the ways that sort of the gendered embodiment of this practice plays out in the case of women who are drumming. Can you talk about that a a little bit for us? Because it's a very powerful and a really interesting chapter here.
Thank you. Well, that's actually, I have to say, that's something that when you're talking about the transition between the dissertation and the book, that's a chapter that actually was not in the dissertation. It was actually written specifically for the book. There's a number of reasons for that, but one big one is that, you know, over the time when I would talk with people about Tycho, the question of, well, what about women? And how is this as a kind of, how could you imagine this as a more masculine activity? And how do you see gender playing out? And it was really something I hadn't taken up in the dissertation, but I'd always thought about. But the book gave me an opportunity to actually explore it in more detail. And so that's what I do in that chapter. Essentially, what I look at in that chapter, and I guess what I'm doing in the second part of the book as a whole, if you take five, six, and seven together, is looking at some of the implications of, as you say, the performance standards and the aesthetic standards of Tycho that emerged out of those processes that I discover, that I talk about in the first part of the book. So one of those is that Tycho, as a new kind of ensemble performance, when we talked about marginalized and then more mainstream populations, this connects to that as well. The fact that it was severed from tradition, and the fact that it's not really considered a traditional activity, ironically, although that may seem to lower its status culturally, it also opened up opportunities for new kinds of people to participate in what looks like folk culture, in the performance of Tycho, and playing on these musical instruments in a way that they hadn't before. And one of those groups is women, because for most of Japanese history, women were marginalized from festival performance because most festivals in Japan are organized around celebrations connected with the indigenous religion of Japan, which is called Shinto. And Shinto has a prohibition, very much so like Buddhism, against pollution. And for much of Japanese history, and to some extent still today, women were seen as polluting beings. And so they were believed to be essentially deleterious, if not fatal, for the delicate spirits, or kami as they were, little gods that inhabited Shinto shrines and were paraded around town during Shinto festivals on these portable shrines called mikoshi. Now, most of the festival ritual patterns, musical patterns, these were called hayashi, in which taiko were used then, were exclusively played by men. When you got a break between the festival religiosity and the instrument itself, this essentially opened up opportunities for women to come in and play. Now, there have been some localities in Japan, many, many more today than there were, say, 60 years ago, that allow women to actually play in festivals. But even if there are, it is the case that women can play in festivals, sometimes internal boundaries within communities are marked that exclude people, that it's only the people of particular subsections of the village can play because their village has traditionally been assigned the task of performing a certain aspect of the ritual or whatever. But with Taiko, the new kinds of Taiko, you don't really have that prohibition. And so you get even some men that weren't able to participate in before that are able to participate now and in performance on these instruments. So to some extent, you could see taiko ensembles, taiko drumming, as a very democratizing force, that it really allows participation of new groups in Japan in the performance of looks like indigenous Japanese music in a way that's never possible before. Women are one of those groups. At the same time, because of the way in which taiko developed primarily around the sort of aesthetic standards and dictates of men, it still has a quite masculine orientation in terms of its performance, approach to performance standards. And so in many ways, women are often held up to the standard of masculine performance. That is, that the kind of power that people will expect from a performance tends to be what they would expect from a man rather than a woman. So you get the case that it tends to be the case that women are affected by this in a couple of ways. Either they have to work hard, extra hard, in order to build their bodies to try to be as strong as men. And so I saw in the course of my field work some groups where women were actually doing weightlifting and bodybuilding to try to increase their muscle mass in order to be as powerful as men in performance. Or by contrast, they would sometimes not even try to equal the men, but would try to essentially sell type of performance on the basis of their femininity. And what was this femininity? Well, it was usually something very different than just raw power or masculinity, something that was more connected with cuteness, the demure, a kind of attractiveness. So in other words, their bodies were perceived not so much for power or performing ability as much as presentation, aesthetic presentation, and even eroticism to some extent. So in that chapter, I sort of discuss these the effects. So you've been able to bring in a whole new population of people, but at the same time, to what degree are they able to really freely participate in this new genre? And so that's what I get at in that chapter. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And one of the interesting things also that you talk about in the chapter immediately before, and I'll just mention this for listeners, yeah, is that you make the point in various ways that it's not just that the standard body is male. The standard body is a Japanese male. And so mm-hmm. there are all kinds of racial and cultural implications to this as well. Which is really interesting in terms of thinking about the notion of a Japanese body being central to this process.
Yes. Very much so. The two were often seen to be the same. It was hard to see which way it's like the chicken and the egg, which way the arrow of causality pointed. If this was a new art form that just suits the Japanese body well, or is it because the Japanese produced it and they have certain kinds of bodies that they then produce this sort of art form? But the two seem to be very closely linked, at least in the way people talked about it.
Right. And this theme of, as we sort of move to the end of the book and the final chapters of the book, this theme of the connection between Taiko and something like a kind of national or racial or cultural identity really plays out in in a couple of different ways. I think one of the interesting things that happens in this last couple chapters of the book is you talk about attempts to standardize Taiko pedagogy, but at the same time attempts to kind of transform this diversity of styles into a national genre. So there's a really interesting discourse of, or sort of practices relating to the standardization and kind of nationalization or attempts to do this in this set of practices. Can you talk a little bit about this issue of, or the ways that textbooks in this later part of the book are being used and have been used to try to standardize Taiko pedagogy? Because it's interesting for readers who are sort of interested in looking at the ways that this phenomenon is not just about performance of kind of physical bodies or performance of material objects, but also performance of words on a page in a text.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I'd say in the second part of the book, you're right, you've nicely articulated a theme of the book better than I actually did, which is what happens. So if you have this art form that is so focused on the body and performance, what are the effects of that? And you're right, in the chapter preceding the one on women, I focus on how the body is then tied in with certain ideas of a race, of a sort of body type, but then also of locality. And in the chapter on women, I look at the gendered effects of that. And in the chapter 7, I take a different perspective. That one of the things that was happening at the time when I was doing my fieldwork is there was a movement by a certain segment of the Taiko community to try to essentially categorize Taiko as a traditional performing art. So, as you know, I was sort of interested initially in this notion of invention tradition. I kind of dropped out as I rewrote the book. But one of the things that I'm trying to draw attention to in this chapter is that there's a tendency in many studies of music and Japanese culture in general, to try to be almost monolithic in your approach. And so to say that taiko drummers do this or taiko is all like this. And what I'm trying to bring out in this section is the sort of diversity within the taiko community, that you have people very much so on the left of the political spectrum, represented by kodo drummers, and before them, onekuza, especially Den Tagayasu. But at the same time, you also have people on the right side of the political spectrum who see in taiko something different than what those on the other side see. And in that sense, they see taiko as reflecting the more earlier martial spirit of Japan, something connected perhaps more with a warrior aesthetic of the samurai, or more recently for them, the actual imperial army and military forces in Japan. And these two lines come together in that last chapter because the people who are interested in sort of authenticating taiko as a traditional performing art or a national performing art, something connected up with the Japanese nation themselves, are also engaged at the same time with the production of a textbook, which for use in their organization. And the people who are primarily pushing in this direction are connected up with an organization called the Nippon Taiko Foundation, in other words, the Japan Taiko Association. I think is the foundation. I think is the translation. Essentially, in order to make sure that their organization has a sort of set way by which people advance through the organization, they come up with, they are attempting to come up with a set of basic taiko patterns that one must master, and then that you can then progressively move through so that you advance up in the ranks of the organization. And what I try to draw attention to in this chapter is not only the political aspects of this, but the way in which this is actually shifting some of the meanings of taiko as an activity, whereas it started out very much so as connected with, you could say, earlier forms of transmitting folk culture in Japan, primarily through oral and visual means, through rote memorization, actually practicing movements over and over until you finally got it, replacing that style of pedagogy with a new style of pedagogy that depends more on texts and adherence to the patterns that are placed in a text. Now, of course, one of the problems that crops up is, well, how do you actually come up with a set of basic taiko patterns? Because this is something that had really never existed before. For example, when I started playing taiko during my fieldwork, we just sort of launched into it. They showed me like a couple ways to hit the drum, and then we started playing a piece right away. But the textbook approach is a little bit different than that. It shows some basic patterns, and then gradually gets to more complex patterns, and then finally you apply those patterns to the performance of a piece. So it sort of breaks up the way in which it's a significant break with the way that taiko had been taught previously, all in the service of trying to bring more people into the fold of this national organization in a way that then you could essentially distinguish yourself as a group of people who play a similar kind of unified way of playing taiko that would be potentially nationally represented in a way that the other groups that I talk about are not at all representative of. So many of them are fiercely attached to the idea of their local practice and see, in many senses, very little connection between what they're doing and other groups in Japan. The mission of the Nippon Taiko Foundation was to try to essentially get rid of some of that idiosyncrasy, to try to create a standard way of playing taiko that would be representative and would be replicated throughout the country, such that you could talk about Japanese drumming as a national category rather than just as a collection of styles where people didn't necessarily agree with the approach to playing.
Great. Well, Sean, we've taken up a lot of your time at this point. I would, I'll just mention for our listeners before we kind of move to wrapping up that there's a wonderful epilogue as well in which you mention the relevance of copyright issues or kind of an emerging set of problems relating to copyright issues and ownership with respect to Tycho. You mentioned these great examples from The Lion King and The Scorpion King where Tycho drumming arises or where Tycho drumming can be heard. And then there's also a great discussion of the place of Tycho in music education in Japan.
Yeah.
Now, there's if we look at or think about these issues, these are only some of the many, many issues that arise in the book. It's an extraordinarily rich study, and we didn't have time to talk about a whole lot of it. Is there anything in particular about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to point out for listeners, especially those who may not yet have had a chance to read the book?
We covered quite a bit. I think we covered quite a bit of the stuff that's in there. I guess, one of the things that I hope that people get out of the book is not just a better understanding of Tycho, which is something that I hope they get out of it, but also that they see it as a kind of lens, a way of looking at Japan and Japanese society. Coming as an anthropologist, I'm hoping that people get out of it a better understanding of changes that are on the ground in Japanese society, that different ways of organizing communities, understanding communities in Japan. I think issues of the body and race, gender, and musicality are important, but I'm hoping that people see those in the context of a broader discussion of Japanese society itself. So if that hadn't been implicit in the discussion thus far, I would hope people would notice that as well.
Great. And now that this book is out, and congratulations on this book, what's next for you? What project is inspiring you right now? What are you working on?
Well, I've gone in a couple of directions. So some of that discussion in the epilogue on traditional music education is connected up with research that I did subsequent to this research on Tycho, actually going into classrooms looking at traditional music education. What is called traditional education in traditional music and traditional musical instruments in public school music classes, just to be entirely clear. So I did some work on that, and I'm looking forward to publishing on that as well. But even more recently, I've gone in a very different direction, moving away from music and looking more at issues related to the aging society in Japan, what's called the aging society, sort of fertility crisis, low fertility, rapid aging Japan, and especially in connection with innovation in science and technology. To be more specific, I was very interested in recent attempts to use robotics technologies to help manage the problems associated with the aging society, in the care of the elderly, both in terms of their psychological care, but also in their physical care as well. So I did a year of fieldwork on this in Japan, and more recently I've also been looking at the export of technologies developed in Japan to solve these problems, export of those technologies abroad to places like in Europe. Most recently, I just came back from Denmark, for example, looking at that. So in a sense, I'm very fascinated by the interaction between people and things and the way that meanings are created in this interaction between people and the kinds of cultural products that they produce, whether that be taiko drums or whether it be furry little robots. But it also, at the same time, the new project that I've taken up takes me in a direction somewhat away from what I'm looking at in the Taiko Boom book, which is exciting for me, I have to say. I don't think at the same time, though, I don't think that I'll ever leave the taiko drumming community entirely. It has a way of staying with you. And partly that's because I just enjoy it, and I enjoy the people that are who are involved in it. I don't know if I will ever do another study on it again. It's quite possible I may. But at this point, I'm engaged more in, again, this project on aging and technological innovation.
Well, best of luck with that project. It's another fascinating sounding project. And once that's done, give me a Skype and we will talk about that one for NBAs as well. Thanks so much, Sean. Thanks for making the time and for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for joining us, and we will see you next time.